Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. It makes no difference to you, dear listener, but I did mean to start this recording, a good half an hour ago, and I have been too distracted playing KDiamond. KDiamond is, conveniently, the next application in the list of applications we're going to go over on the Slackware install media. KDiamond is part of the KDE package. It is a little, game. Sort of like a Connect Four, not really though. What do you call it? Like a Candy Crush, maybe? Is it a, it might be Candy Crush. I don't know if, I've never played Candy Crush. So, but I think this is that kind of game where it opens up and there's an array of gems in this case. And actually, of course, because it's a KDE game, you can change the theme. So there are different icons that you can use. But I have it set to a sort of a gem. Oh, this is a cool one. Folios, a leaf theme for KDiamond. I'm going to install that right now. So you have an array of say gems, and you click on two of them. You click on one and then another, and they need to be, they have to be adjacent to one another. You click on them, and they swap places. And after you've, if after you have clicked on them and they've swapped places, if there are three or more contiguous leaves, then those leaves are, or diamonds or gems, whatever. I just switched to the leaf theme now. So I recommend the leaf theme. It's actually quite pleasant. And those leaves are then removed from the board, so it collapses. And the aim of the game is to just keep doing that for as long as you have. It can be a timed game, although you can play it untimed. And for every row that you eliminate, or every, you know, for some number of leaves, you get some number of points. I haven't been able to track exactly what the scoring is, just because I keep getting distracted by the game itself. It seems to be 1 point for a row of three, and then I'm the thing I can't figure out necessarily is how many points there are for a row of more than three. But either way, you can just collect points by clicking on diamonds or leaves or whatever theme you're using and eliminating them. And it's an endless stream, so it's not like you're ever going to clear off the game board. It is just endless stream of things. And of course, if you remove, you know, the big satisfying thing is when you remove a row of leaves, which then moves other leaves into position to then be removed. So you get those chain reactions, and those are always cool. This isn't very glitzy and sparkly like I believe games like Candy Crush to be. I mean, I haven't played Candy Crush. I've heard of it. I have this notion in my head, I don't know where I got it from, but there's a lot of sparkles and explosions and shakings, and this isn't like that. But it is very much the same kind of idle click game that you can just kind of mindlessly click, and there's a lot of satisfaction to seeing things sort of get cleared out, and yet never get cleared out. I imagine it would probably drive you crazy after a little while, because there is just no end to it. Like, there's no goal. You play until time is up. And the time does seem to go almost slowly in a weird way. I felt like it was going a lot longer than, I think it started with 3 minutes, and it just felt like it was going on forever. Not in a bad way necessarily, but there's not, what I'm saying is that it's, I guess, a calm game. You don't really feel any kind of urgency until maybe the last couple of seconds when you realize, okay, well, now this is it. Get as many as you can. It's also not a very, I would say, it's not a very serious game, by which I mean, you know, if you tell me that I want to get as many points within a certain time constraint, then what goes through my head first is that I should be able to, I shouldn't have to wait for animations. That just doesn't seem right to me as in the part of my brain that is a gamer. That doesn't seem right that I have to wait for animations before I can click something else. At the very least, and I understand that the game board is changing, so you have to wait for things to resolve, but at the very least, I should be able to queue things up even while animations are happening. If the result of an animation renders one of my choices obsolete, that's fine. Just skip over that action. Don't carry, go on to the next one. But I should at least be able to progress my game while things are being resolved elsewhere. And then the second thing that it struck me was that you can't really position, you can't queue things up in the sense of, you can't set yourself up for clever chain reactions. If you see something that could be moved into a position, if you just moved that one object over just a little bit and then had that thing collapse, you can't do that. You can only move things into, you can only swap objects into position as long as they will result in a collapse of leaves. So for instance, if I have two leaves next to each other and I just want to swap them so that I can trigger a chain reaction somewhere else and then have those be in position to then disappear once everything else falls into place, you can't do that. You can only swap two objects as long as you're moving something into a contiguous row of three or more. So that's a little bit annoying from a gaming the system perspective. But I mean, that's the kind of game this is. It's one of those idle kinds of games where you're not really, I don't think, intended to take it too seriously. It is not super strategic. It is a thing to click and to pass your time with. Again, I can imagine that if you're compiling something and you decide, well, I don't want to walk away and get coffee because maybe I just got coffee, but I don't want to also just stare at my screen as the code compiles, I think I'll open up KDiamond. It's perfectly serviceable for that purpose. Next application. Oh, no, wait, sorry. One more thing about KDiamond. It strikes me that a lot of these KDE desktop games they have certain aspects of them that I feel is really significant, and I kind of wish more games would sort of adopt, maybe. And one of those certainly is the themeability of them. I mean, it's to me, it's priceless that they are themeable. I think that's a big deal. KDiamond, for instance, if you do the default configuration, which is the Egyptian theme, which normally I like, because I'm a fan of all things Egyptian. But I'll admit that the pale green and the pale blue, the shades of the, the colors of these little diamonds, the pale green and pale blue, to someone who doesn't distinguish colors all that well, or maybe has to have their screen, tuned in a certain way, I can see those being very indistinguishable from one another. Heck, I don't consider myself, I don't consider myself super adept or sensitive to color, but I do consider myself sort of, I can tell colors apart, I generally can do that. But I mean, even I got some of the green and the blues mixed up. I would click on a diamond to swap them, and it wouldn't swap, and I'd realize, oh, I'm trying to move a green diamond into a blue row, thinking that that was going to make one contiguous row, and it didn't. So the fact that you can theme it is huge. I mean, especially if you really do have a problem distinguishing colors for whatever reason, whether it's just you don't see colors the same way as other people do, or you don't see as well as other people do. Being able to theme it, I think, is huge. And like the leaf theme, for instance, doesn't rely on colors. You could play that on a black and white screen because the leaves are in a different position. They're different shapes, they're different positions. You don't have to rely on the color at all. So that kind of thing. And I mean, you know, not everything is a complete package. I mean, this doesn't have a sound, you know, a sound only mode like the K, what was it? K Memory or K Square or whatever that one was called, the memory game. But the fact that they are so flexible is just, to me, it's really, really a big deal. And I think it's something that in general, the gaming industry could, heck, the software application industry should take note of. That's a big, big deal. And I don't know, I haven't looked into the theming aspect. I don't know what it takes to create a theme for something. But I would love it if that kind of thing became really, really simple for users. Like trivial. Like really, really trivial. Like it should be the obvious choice to contribute to your first open source project should be, oh, make a new theme for this application or for this game or for this whatever. Like your window decorate, you know, like all that stuff should just be so simple. And I understand that's asking for a lot. It's saying, let's rethink architecture. But I don't know. I think that's the way that we need to go. So the fact that KDiamond and all these games so far have actually generally made it really easy for that to happen, I think is a really, really big deal. Okay, next up is KDSSSD. KDSSD is a network monitor for ZeroConf. ZeroConf is the sort of mythical, no DNS server required networking protocol, ZeroConf, or Avahi, I think is the other name for it. And then I think there was another name for it called Bonjour. So whatever you're calling it, the idea is that you have a network, and you don't need to spin up a DNS server or service to keep track of the names of the devices on your network. You just, each device gets a name when it gets set up. You know, when you install your operating system on that device, it gets a name. It could be a generic name like your username, /s-computer.local, which is a horrible naming scheme, but that's what some companies do. But then they, of course, they have to remove the apostrophe because that's not a valid thing in the host name. So anyway, it's silly, but so whatever, your username and then something and then .local and so on. And that's a common kind of scheme for host names. And ZeroConf monitors your network, detects those host names and lists them for you so that when you want to connect to another computer, you can go over to your local network, find another computer to connect to, and as long as you have permissions to connect to that thing, then you can. And I have to admit, I have done very little with ZeroConf. I also have to admit that I don't feel like it has been very, I don't think it's been placed in a very significant place in desktop computing so far. I feel like the companies that use it in earnest hide it from their users so that their users are shocked to see that their folders are visible on a network or whatever. And then the places that don't use it have it available, but again, it's not that big of a deal to their users, and so people kind of forget about it. That has been my experience. I don't know if that's been everyone's experience, but I have not found that there has been a lot of adoption of ZeroConf in general. I don't know. Again, that's just my experience. It could be unique to me. I don't feel like it is explained very clearly to people where to set that stuff up and what the constraints are. I do think it's technically or theoretically, I should say, a useful thing. You know, certainly it would be nice for this to be clearly explained to people and really easy to interface with and so on. KDNSSSD is a set of libraries to help developers integrate ZeroConf into their applications. That's what this package set is. So there's a couple of README files, And there's a bunch of include files in user include KF5, of course, KDE framework, some CMake files to help everything get configured correctly, and then probably, yeah, translation files. Let's talk a little bit about XML now. KDocTools is a package to help developers output documentation from DocBook files. I've talked about DocBook in the past. I'm a really big fan of DocBook, actually. I'm a big fan of XML, really, because I just love how explicit XML, the format, the schema, is. It doesn't leave a whole lot to question. It doesn't leave much to interpretation. It's very clear, for instance, when a tag opens and closes. There's not a whole lot of room for interpretation there. It's just there. And if a tag ends in a place that it's not allowed to end, then your XML linter will catch that and tell you that it's wrong, because XML has a schema, a list of permitted sort of nestings. Like if something can be a parent of another thing, then it gets through. But if it's not possible for that thing to be a parent of this other thing, then it flags an error. And so XML is really nice because it fails early. And I've said this before, but that sounds like a bad thing. To fail sounds bad. But failing early is actually really good, and it's a lot better than, for instance, failing later. Because when it fails later in the process, then you don't know how much you've built on top of that. Whereas if it fails early, you know to stop, fix the problem, and then continue building. That's such an undervalued feature, I feel. And XML, as opposed to a lot of the common alternatives like Markdown or even ASCII doc, things like that. And ASCII doc compiles out to XML, so to DocBook specifically, so that's a little bit better. There's that step before you get the errors, but ASCII doc probably, I would say, a little bit safer than Markdown. And I guess, you know, in theory, HTML or something like that should be good. It's almost a form of XML. I mean, it was for a while. XHTML still is, but I find that there's such a tradition of leniency and quirks modes for HTML that you don't actually get to see the failures a lot of times, because the tool chain just isn't built for that. The tool chain is more frequently built to withstand failure. So XML, I have a lot of fondness for, and for a very long time, DocBook, I feel, was kind of the documentation method for technical projects. And since Markdown has kind of gotten popular, DocBook has fallen out of favor a little bit. Luckily, ASCII doc came in and kind of did this hybrid model of something that feels a lot like Markdown, but in the end gets compiled out to DocBook. And that's been, I think, it's been huge. And I wish ASCII doc would get wider adoption for it. I was using ASCII doc for everything for a while, until I just realized that no one I was interfacing with was using it. And so it was just causing really more problems than it was providing benefits. And yes, you can render out, you know, you can transform your ASCII doc to DocBook and then transform your DocBook to really anything. But a lot of the tools to do that transformation would insert a lot of unnecessary additional stuff that people would have to end up removing. So I had to migrate away from ASCII doc. And when I'm interfacing with other people for my current projects, I really write just mostly in raw HTML now. It just seems to be the most direct way to output, but not necessarily. Some a little bit of Markdown here and there, a little bit of DocBook for my personal stuff. KDocTools was built around DocBook though. So there are a couple of different utility scripts here. There's check XML5 and I don't know how to say this. I assume it's Mine Proc 5, M-E-I-N Proc 5. And then there's documentation about the documentation tools, share files, XML style sheets, and things like that. So the two executables, check XML 5 and Mine Proc 5 or whatever it was, are one, check XML 5 is essentially an XML lint do-over. So it's XML lint except specifically for KDE documentation. So it has specialized checks that it'll do, just like XML lint does. And XML lint, if you have never used it, it's a linter. And if you've never used a linter checks code. It scans through code and it verifies that that code meets some prerequisite. This is especially convenient for a programmer to have because you can then find errors in what you have typed rather than checking something to see, finding an error during the compile stage. Or in the case of XML, it's not really being compiled, but it's being transformed. Check XML 5 looks through your code and makes sure that you don't have errors that it can't parse, and it ensures that you have things that are there that it knows are going to be required specifically by the KDE documentation system. MineProc 5 is a transform application, so it takes XML, it parses it, and it transforms it into something else, specifically HTML. This is the beauty of XML. It expects, at least in documentation terms, or maybe in all terms, XML expects to be transformed into something else. There are very few instances, I wouldn't think, where XML is considered the sort of the final version of data. It's a storage medium. You put stuff into XML so that you can then draw from it and use it elsewhere. Whether that is, you're taking the XML and transforming it from XML to HTML so that you can post a website on the internet that people can browse to in their web browser, or whether you're storing XML configuration files so that then a Java application can parse that, can, or any application, I just use Java because it's common in Java. It can parse that and load in configuration options, preferences, or whatever. It could be a sort of a quick and dirty solution to a sort of a lightweight database or whatever. So lots of different reasons you might want to put stuff into XML for documentation. It's just a great way to have very, very clearly defined elements of content that you can then use a transform application such as MineProc 5 or XSLT Proc or XML2 or Pandoc. Lots of different applications out there to transform something from XML to some other format. And that's a good thing. That's its big advantage, I think, or one of its big advantages anyway. Next one is K-Edit Bookmarks. And this is a cool one, not so much for what it is, but for what it kind of deals with. There are a couple of applications within the KDE ecosystem that has an option to create bookmarks. And one of the obvious ones probably is Conqueror. It's got bookmarks. It does web browsing. That's a pretty standard concept. But also things like Console has bookmarks, and Conversation has bookmarks. The Console bookmarks I didn't even realize existed until I stumbled across K-Edit Bookmarks and read the documentation about it and realized there is a way that you can bookmark common locations on your system, and when you open Console, by the way, is the KDE terminal, in case you're not sure, you can choose bookmarks, go to your bookmark collection, and open the whole folder of bookmarks, so all of the bookmarks that you've gathered together for a specific purpose, in tabs in Console. So if you're frequently, opening Console to do some testing on a Python application you're writing. Maybe you've got one tab open to the Python application itself. Maybe you've got another tab open to the location on your system where those Python configuration files or data files are stored that interface with that Python application. Maybe you've got another one open to your home directory because you've got some assets there that you frequently refer to, whatever. You go to the bookmark collection, you say open in tabs, bang, 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 you're there. You've got a console tab now open to each of those locations, and you're ready to start working. So any variation of that scenario, you can get to a location, or I think more importantly, more significantly, to several locations with essentially, you know, one click, which is quite nice. And it's kind of funny to say that that's quite nice, because I mean, this is the terminal, why are you clicking at all? But I mean, it is a modern terminal, it's got conveniences. And one of those conveniences I have, new conveniences that I've discovered, is that bookmark feature, because there are places that I typically do kind of navigate to for specific tasks. And as ridiculous as it may seem, just sometimes typing the full path to that location is just too much trouble. Now, I could make an alias for it or something, or a symlink to make it really simple, but the act of opening up a new tab in console isn't necessarily super easy. And I don't know. What I'm saying is, it's convenient sometimes to have this sort of to take advantage of that GUI layer that you've got in a emulated terminal, and make things quicker for yourself. So that's a bookmark feature. There's one weird thing about the bookmark feature in at least the KDE version that I'm running here on Slackware, the 25th anniversary version, whatever that is, 5.14 or whatever. It's the bookmark, when you add it to your toolbar, it is just the word bookmarks. And what's weird about that is that I have my icons set to be icon only. And then, so if you go into sort of, configure toolbars, you'll see that bookmarks is, for whatever reason, it has no icon and it has text. So what you can do is you can click on it's in, where did it go? Actually, now I don't even see it. Main toolbar. There it is. Bookmarks. Click on it and then click change text, which is a button down at the bottom, and click hide text when toolbar shows text alongside icons, and then change icon and set it to an icon. And I did a search for bookmark. And there's a bookmark icon, bookmark-toolbar, set that to the icon, and then you've got a nice little bookmark icon. And I say this is important to me because I have my toolbar on the left, sort of down the side. So anything bigger than a small icon makes that left panel uncomfortably large. So I just put icons alongside there. So I need it to be icons, not text. And that's what it is now. So anyway, the reason I'm mentioning that obviously is because of this application called KEdit Bookmarks, which is you'll recall that many things in KDE are designed as KCM or KDE config modules, or what are they called? Parts. There's a Kate part, there's this part, that part. Well, this is one of those things. I don't know what it qualifies as because I haven't looked that deeply into how it was programmed, but it's a bookmark editor, and it is shared between applications like Conqueror, Console, Conversation, and whatever else has an edit the bookmark feature. So it's also a standalone application that then is able to see bookmarks from lots of different locations. Having said that, however, I've got bookmarks in Console, or a collection of bookmarks, and I'm not seeing it in KEdit Bookmark. So I'm not sure exactly what's going on there, but in theory, it should be, from what I've been reading, it should be here. It should be visible here, but I cannot see those. You can import bookmarks. You can import bookmarks from lots of different browsers. You can create new bookmarks and so on. And that's nice, but it does feel a little bit almost as if though it assumes that you're using that these bookmarks are being used in Conqueror, because it feels a little bit specific to web browsing purposes. I'm not sure if the intent of the application was to encompass more than Conqueror, or whether the documentation is simply misleading, suggesting that it's a bookmark editor across all applications, when what it really means is that it edits bookmarks just for Conqueror. But of course, I mean, that's just the standalone application. The part, the edit bookmark part, or whatever it is, itself works as expected. So if I go to a menu, Control Shift M in console to see my menu. Oh, I see. It changed my, I never noticed that. It changed my menu to an icon. That's kind of cool. I like that. I'm going to leave it like that. So if I go there and I go to edit bookmarks, to my bookmark menu, edit bookmarks, then I'm looking at my console bookmarks and I can manipulate them from there. So it's using the same backend, obviously. It just looks like if you launch it as a standalone application, what it's really doing is launching the console, the Conqueror version of that application. There are a bunch of options for that command in case you do want to use the Conqueror edition of that. There are things to, there's like a flag dash dash export HTML where you can export all the bookmarks from Conqueror into a printable HTML file. You can import things like dash dash import Moz, M-O-Z, to import from Mozilla Firefox bookmark file, or import IE from Internet Explorer favorite format, and even Netscape Explorer 4.x, and export in the Mozilla format, and so on. There's also supposedly a dash dash no browser function, which hides all browser-related functions. I couldn't tell the difference for that at all. And then there's also a custom caption, which is not very useful. I was hoping it was going to be a way to launch something that would actually look at console, and it doesn't. It just sets like the, it's supposed to set the somewhere, the caption. Actually, I don't even see where it's setting that now. So yeah, standalone, you're essentially, from what I can tell, you're essentially starting just a small portion of Conqueror. But like I say, you actually do interact with that same code from within console or from within another application, just not as a standalone. So in other words, this application has been quite eye-opening for me in terms of the possibilities that it's made available, because now I know that bookmarks exist in, for instance, console, but as an application, it's not ever something I will launch. I will just launch, I will interact with it through console. Let's go have a cup of coffee. We'll come back and finish this episode up. Coffee has been acquired, and coffee in this case, of course, is being spelt with a K. Next application is K-emoticons. It's not really an application, it's a collection of PNG files to replace common combinations of characters with little pictures of smiley faces and rocket ships and other things. So this actually encompasses more than just actual emoticons. And in case you don't know, my understanding is that originally there were emoticons. Emoticons were at some point is what people called the combination of like a colon and a parentheses to equal a smiley face. Smiley face turned on its side. A colon and another parentheses facing the other way would be a frowny face, and so on. And then at some point, someone came up with the idea of emoji. And emoji were the same idea, except it would swap out some combination of special characters with an image. And these images were created using, I guess, TrueType or whatever fonts use these days. And so essentially it's a graphical font. And emoji seem to be pretty popular today. I mean, people, I think, actually probably arguably even default to those over emoticons these days. I could be wrong about that, but it feels like that. And there are some advantages to emoji. From what I understand, emoji are a little bit more accessible for non-sighted users, because instead of being just, you know, colon, dash, right-facing parentheses, you actually hear the description of the emoji to some degree. I can't think of one right now. Colon coffee cup probably, or steaming beverage or something like that. Close colon. So from what I understand, it's a little bit better for hearing an image rather than seeing an image. And certainly there are a lot more emojis than there are emoticons, I think. And I think there would be probably it's probably inarguable that there would be more possible character combinations for emoji, because you can just draw on all kinds of Unicode encoding or symbols or characters, I guess. Glyphs, I guess, is what they're called. Whereas emoticons require you to be sort of drawing a picture with ASCII characters, all 128 of them or whatever there are. And it gets to be a little bit limited, I think. So, although I guess it depends. You could also say, okay, well, our new emoticon method is going to just be arbitrary, and you don't really have to draw anything. But I mean, that kind of defeats the purpose. So anyway, emoticons, K emoticons, is the KDE collection of the little images it's going to replace when you do like a colon dash parentheses, or a colon, or semicolon dash parentheses. Can't think of that many emoticons really. So that's what those are. And then it also encompasses a bunch of emoji. I don't know how many emoji. Let's do sort of like a maybe a grep for emoji. Actually, I'm going to do a dash I for case insensitivity, and then I'm going to do a word count dash L to count the lines. 1,626 emoji PNGs are listed in this collection. That's a lot. There's probably not nearly as many as actually exist, but I think there are quite a lot of emoji. I'm gonna display one at random. Yep, that's an emoji. It's a flag of some sort. Okay, so yeah, there's just a bunch of emoticons and emoji graphics. They're all PNGs, and they're all in user share emoticons. Now, some of them, as I say, are called emoticons, and then some of them are called emoji one, is what they're, I don't know what that refers to, but that's what they're designated as. So there you go. Those are the emojis. Who doesn't love a little bit of metadata? I've talked about this before, I'm pretty sure, and I just wish there was a better way of doing metadata. And I know I've talked about this because people have emailed me a couple of times about this topic. And even with the collaboration of you, dear listener, I'm not satisfied with all the options made available to us as computer users to create and review and search against, or query, and just kind of interact with metadata. I also don't like it when metadata is forced upon us, as it often is in music playing applications, for instance. For the longest time, I just didn't want to use metadata for my files. I knew where my music was. That's what I wanted to use. But every single player I could find would try to insist on showing me only what information it could extract from the files, rather than just looking at the file system. So I don't know. I want both things, and I want them both to be easy. And I realize that a lot of metadata, honestly, really, really does depend on either file format or on file system. Like literally, like the file system that you're using, such as EXT4 or JFS or XFS or whatever. So, FAT32, whatever. So both of those things, you can develop your own and have whatever you want, but then you've got your own special thing that no one else is using. And so then when you take a file from one system to another, you lose all of those extra features. And at that point, what good is it anyway? So I think that this is a big, big issue that faces computer users everywhere. But I just don't think that any, I don't hold out any hope for the wider community of computer users, that is like everyone in the world, to all decide that metadata is really quite important, and it should be super easy to edit, and it should be supported by all file systems and all applications. That's just not going to happen. So anyway, it isn't where I think it should be. But K file metadata is a library set for KDE for programmers to be able to use, so that their applications can quickly and easily extract text and metadata from lots of different kinds of files. So this isn't something that you and I are going to use unless you are a developer developing something for KDE, but there, this is a collection of .so files that extract metadata, so, like I say, from like an EPUB file. An EPUB has metadata embedded into it, such as the author, the title of the book, probably the page count, maybe, I don't know. No, probably not the page count, because EPUBs are screen things. They don't have pages. I mean, they do, but it'll change. I don't know, whatever, you know, like whatever, definitely author, like that's DC colon creator and DC colon title, I think are the two things that you generally put into an XML file, speaking of XML, in the root level of your EPUB, and then that can be extracted by something so that when you're looking at your EPUB collection, you see them by titles and authors rather than by file names. There's an EXIV2 extractor, there's an FFmpeg extractor, ODF extractor for Open Document Foundation, Office 2007 extractor, Office extractor, I guess those must be for older versions of LibreOffice. I'm just kidding, that's like Microsoft Office probably. Plain text extractor, PO extractor, Poplar extractor, PostScript, there's a lot of great stuff in there. XML extractor and taglib extractor. So those are all extractors that there's a writer, there's a taglib writer, so that your application can then write metadata as well. And believe me, that's the kind of thing, that's exactly what you want as a developer. That's exactly what you want when something, you know, when you're programming, there's, at least for me, there's a certain threshold of stuff that you're willing to invent versus the stuff that you don't want to have to think about and just should already exist. And I think metadata extraction is one of those things that should just already exist. I mean, otherwise, why are you using a framework? Why are you using a library set at all? Why don't you just, why not just program everything from the ground up? So it is really great that KDE Framework has that kind of thing available, because it's just something that you're going to want, you're going to need almost, if you're doing an application, you know, for that sort of, where you're dealing with media files or documents. And that makes it super easy. You just invoke that library, you learn a couple of methods, you figure out what your, you know, how it works, and you plug it right into your application, and you don't have to think about how it's happening. It just happens magically. So that's a really, really great. That's like, I think one of the obvious examples of why you would want to use a framework. It's just, that makes things so easy. And I mean, honestly, when I'm fiddling around with code, I very frequently wish there was a lot more of that, because there are just sometimes there's a thing that you're doing and you're just like, surely someone else has done this before. Like, surely someone has iterated over an array of images and made them into thumbnails before. Like, where's the thing that'll do that for me? Because you can picture what you want to do, and you know the process. You just don't want to have to physically go through it again, knowing that someone else has surely done this before. But it's not always easy to go and find where that's been done and then to extract the parts of it that perform the action and integrate it into your code. But when it's a library, that's exactly what you do. You just include that library, you make a call to the method that does the thing that you want it to do, and you're done. It's that simple. Okay, kfind is up next, and it's a search application for your KDE Plasma desktop. It finds files and directories in KDE. The kfind tool is a useful method of searching for specific files on your computer or for searching for files that match a pattern. An example of this would include blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we know what that means. Okay. So, once again, this is kind of it's a front end to the find command, is really essentially what it is. So, you could look for something. Let's do horror, H-O-R-R-O-R, horror. And then I'm going to tell it to look in my thumb drive, and I'll include subfolders. I will not do a case sensitive search, thereby leaving it case insensitive. Use files index. That seems useful. Show hidden files? No, because those will just be backup files. And then click find. And then you wait. You wait for it to search the location that you've decided to search. And it is still searching and it has found nothing. And it is ramping up. There we go. It's CPU. And we've got some files. Okay, here we go. So it's found some ebooks. And it has found some text files about horror that I've written, and it's still searching. There should be a lot more than this, actually. But yeah, so that's what it does. And as it's searching, I'm going to go over to a different tab here. There's contents, so you can search contents of things. You can search properties of things. For instance, you could find all the files created or modified between two dates, or during the previous some number of days, or a file size, you know, being equal to or at least a certain amount of kilobytes or megabytes or whatever, owned by a certain user, owned by certain groups, and so on. So you can really kind of get very specific about what you're looking for. I don't know exactly what this actually... Oh, wait, I think... Okay, I'm going to actually restart this find without the use files index. Because I don't know, maybe that, I thought it would like use file index for what it could use and then continue after that, but it might actually constrain it to only using a files index. Anyway, as I was saying, I don't know what it's actually using on the back end. I don't know if it's actually literally using the find command or whether it's something else, but essentially it's a front end to find. And I've talked about find before. I love that tool. I use it all the time. This gives you a lot of the same capabilities as the find command, so I'm kind of feeling like it's probably just a front end, but especially things, you know, where you think, okay, well, I want to find files between these two dates, because I know I was working on it, you know, last week, so I'll do that, or something like that. That's hard to remember sometimes for the find command, unless you use it a lot, or, I mean, if you're really skilled at reading man pages, you could probably figure it out, but sometimes it's just kind of nice to have a GUI front end to just, so you don't have to think about the flags and the options. You just do some check marks, everything, you know, it's like a menu, everything is there, you just have to choose what you want to enable, so that is kind of convenient, could be convenient, maybe. Having said all of that, you know, I don't actually use this. I don't use kfind. I know it exists. I know it also exists within Dolphin, or a find function, rather, exists within Dolphin. And I don't use that. I mean, I've probably used it once or twice, but I don't generally use that. So these are tools that I should probably use more to get, like, sort of more familiar with what works, what doesn't work, what works best, that sort of thing. But yeah, obviously once you find a tool that you're really comfortable with, like just the find command, and then piping the results of the find command to parallel to do something really quickly, it's really hard to get away from that. And not only is it hard to get away from it, it's hard to justify getting away from it because, I mean, it's working. It works well. Why would you change? Okay. Next up is Kfloppy. Kfloppy is a utility that provides a way to format 3.5 inch and 5.25 inch floppy disks, believe it or not. I'm pretty sure there are USB 3.5 floppy drives. I'm pretty sure I've seen those. I mean, not lately, but I they did exist at least at one point. They probably still exist. 5.5 1/4, I don't know. That seems like, I don't know about that one. But anyway, if you've got a floppy drive and you've got it, such that it will interface with a modern computer, you have Kfloppy so that you can format that disk. Now we're talking, I think, if memory serves, for a 3.5 inch floppy, I think it was 1.4 megabytes in size, maximum, like 1.4 megabytes. 5 1/4, I don't even know what that was. I mean, I could look it up, but so could you. It would be not a lot. So anyway, that exists, believe it or not. I mean, I love that exists. That's the kind of thing, you know, that's what Linux should have, is just ridiculous levels of backwards compatibility. Like, that's a beautiful thing. Okay. Next one is, maybe possibly the last one. We could open up with a game and then end with a game. This is a Connect 4 game. So, the computer, you can play against a computer, you can play against a friend. They drop a little token into sort of a grid, and the goal is for them to connect four, and the goal for you is to connect four. Now, as you can imagine, one of the techniques used in this game is to block one another from connecting four. So there's a little bit of a defensive mode as well as sort of an offensive mode. This is very straightforward. It's a nice little KDE game. It's fun. It's a challenge. The computer is probably maybe a little too smart, even on the easy function, or maybe I'm just frustrated because I wanted to win really easily without thinking about it. But yeah, it's well enough done. It's a good little game. It's a challenge. It's a real challenge, actually. Yeah, they just keep winning. The computer computer just keeps winning. That's all right. But K4 in line is a good fun game. If you've ever played, I think Connect 4 is what it was called, or Pente. That was Connect 5, actually, I think. But yeah, if you've ever played that, then you know this game. Now, apparently, there is a way to play this networked. So you can essentially start a little Connect 4 server and have a friend connect to your instance and play each other over the network. I mean, you can also just do couch co-op where you drop a token and then your friend, you hand the mouse to your friend and they drop a token and so on. So it's, but I mean, for a KDE game to have both an AI mode and a co-op version and a network, like a built-in little server so you can play over a network, that's pretty amazing. So that's a really neat feature, and I wish all KDE games had the network feature. I think that's a really great idea. Of course, over a network, you know, you'd have to do either, you could do it as a LAN party, sort of. I don't know if that qualifies, Connect 4 LAN party. You could do it on your local network, but if you obviously wanted to do it over the big internet network, then you'd have to open a port in your firewall and forward requests to that port to your computer. So you'd have to do that in order to get people to allow access to your computer at a specific port where that little K4 inline server is running. But you could do it, and I think that's a neat option. Okay, I think that's probably it for this episode. There are yet more. There's more KDE. We're up to K Gamma 5. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.